Our guest today is one of India's most experienced intelligence veterans. He served as the chief of RAW and later advised Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee on Kashmir affairs. Now we know him more as an author and commentator. Mr. Amarjit Singh Dhullad Sahab, we are delighted to have you with us to have this conversation. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to have known you, let me put it that way.
Thank you. Let's start with your birth in Sialkot, pre-independence, and then moving to India after independence or at the time of partition, experiencing what many others experienced like you, the discovery of a new world around yourself. How did that impact your understanding of geopolitics, if at all it did?
The Punjabis belong to either that side or this side. Fortunately, my father was from this side, although my mother was from the other side, from West Punjab. And it so happened that when partition occurred, my father was posted in Rawalpindi as a district judge there. And he waited for his orders, which came late. They only came in September.
Mm-hmm.
When we shifted to Delhi, we began to realize what this different world was. Because after being wherever, Delhi was a different place.
If I may just focus for a moment on how many people perceive intelligence networks, how they see intelligence networks to be, particularly in recent times, to be associated with machines, with the internet. But I believe you put a very special emphasis on the human element, the role of the human being at the head of the machine. How does that play out in modern times?
A lot has changed, as you mentioned, sir. A lot has changed. Tech has improved vastly. That is one of the reasons for our affinity with Israel. But I still believe, I belong to the old school, that this is a very patient game. It's a long game, and it takes time. There's no instant answers. I used to tell the younger officers that this is not like Nescafe. You can instantly have a cup of coffee. It takes time. And when I joined the Bureau in March 69, everything used to come by dark, and whatever reports came from the field, they came by dark. And if you talked on the phone, you had to be very careful about what you were saying where. But I still believe the human portion is more important than any technology you might have. And I think this is a lazy way of gathering intelligence, if you ask me. But if you are ignoring the human being, and any human being has faults, he will not be totally accurate. I used to argue that actually double agents are the best agents who work for both sides, because they will come and at least tell us what's happening in Pakistan or wherever it was.
Now, you are known, if I'm right in saying this, you're known as Mr. Kashmir. How do you to reflect on the time that you spent in Kashmir? Because that was also the time that insurgency was beginning to explode and to spread. And you would obviously have done your utmost to ensure that it could be contained. So how do you, when you think back and you reflect on it, what are your sentiments?
First of all, this Mr. Kashmir is a very flattering moniker. But I've spent a long time in Kashmir. You know, a lot of people think I lived there for a long time. I didn't. My posting was only 2 years. But then circumstances were such that I got stuck to Kashmir. If I'd not gone to Kashmir, I would have retired as a normal Babu anywhere. And I would certainly not have headed the RNAW or landed up in Vajpayee's PMO. After all, why was I brought into the PMO? The day I left the RNAW, Brijesh Mishra said to me, "You're joining us," and I was taken aback. He said, "I just want you to maintain a low profile, but you are here to to monitor Kashmir, look into Kashmir.
So you were, obviously, you continued with your engagement with Kashmir, and then you had the great advantage of working closely to Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee, who gave that so-called message to Jammu and Kashmir, and the message of Jamhuriyat, Insaniyat, etc.
Kashmiriyat.
And Kashmiriyat.
On a visit to Srinagar, one of these reporters there asked him that you're talking about engagement with the Kashmiris, and will it be within the parameters of the constitution? So Atalji said, hum constitution ki baat kyun karte hain? And that is when he said those words, you know. And the Kashmiri still remembers those words.
Well, just take a pause here, because something terrible happened recently, and it's been received with great alarm and sadness. And that was that out-of-the-blue attack on Farooq Abdullah Saab by somebody who claims that he wanted to kill him for God knows how many years. But is this just something random, or do you think that this is a straw in the wind about something that we need to look at more carefully?
I think we need to look at it more carefully if we are interested in Kashmir, because you mentioned Mr. Kashmir. I say that Farooq is the only leader in Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the tallest, but he is today the only leader in Kashmir. And I shudder to think what will happen. Two things are obvious to my mind. One is that Pakistan will be delighted that Farooq is out of the way, just as they were when the Sheikh died. You remember in 82?
Yes.
And that's when it encouraged Pakistan to plan coming into Kashmir. I think the same thing will happen when Farooq disappears from the scene. And the other thing is that his party will finish, it will end. There'll be no national conference. And one of the first things that Farooq mentioned to me when I met him in 87, 88, he says, don't tell lies.
Don't tell lies.
Don't tell lies. There have been officers here who lie to Delhi. Tell them the truth.
Okay.
And I think those are some of the best words that I
that
heard in Kashmir.
That you worked for
and,
him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned when we talk about Kashmir, we talk about the leadership, people like Farooq Abdullah Saab. Somewhere along, Pakistan gets mentioned. Because I know that there is, unfortunately, a sad link with what we do with Pakistan and what we do with Jammu and Kashmir, which is unfortunate. We should have dealt with Jammu and Kashmir, dehorse Pakistan and anything else. But this is the reality of life. And obviously, Pakistan is to blame for much of this. Where do you think we stand with Pakistan today?
Now, coming to Pakistan and Kashmir, just one point here. Farooq, time and time again, has very emphatically said that terror will not go away till we engage with Pakistan. And I can tell you, Pakistan doesn't love Farooq. They quite hate him. Again, because of his bigness, you know. So, it's... of course, things today are at their worst. I think the best time was Musharraf's time. Having watched Kashmir for close to 40 years, I don't think there's been any other Pakistani leader who was as reasonable on Kashmir as Musharraf was. Time and time again, he said, whatever is acceptable to Kashmir and Kashmiris will be acceptable to Pakistan. No other Pakistani leader had the gumption to say that. And he said it. And, I mean, if we had to believe Dr. Manmohan Singh when he was demitting office, he said the deal was almost done. But it didn't happen. He wanted it more than anything else. But he couldn't
do
trouble, it.
The trouble there was that there were people who had obviously made up their mind that they wouldn't let Dr. Manmohan Singh succeed in this.
That's right.
And he was so concerned that he was carefully avoiding visiting his home village.
That's right.
In Pakistan. Obviously, if he could have done it, nobody really helped him do it. I think that's the problem. Did the same thing happen with Mr. Vajpayee?
No, Vajpayee would have done what he wanted to do. Nobody could stop Vajpayee, you know. Once Vajpayee made up his mind, at times Advani could sulk, but he couldn't come in his way. He could never stop him.
No, Mr.
Except for the Agra summit.
That's what I wanted
Agra
to ask.
Agra summit,
yes.
Frustrated Atalji when he came back. He was sad because he wanted it done. But it didn't happen. But that's the only occasion that I can remember. Otherwise, Atalji always had his way.
May I just bring you to the present conflict in West Asia? Given the way things have panned out, clearly there were many assumptions that were made that seem to have gone wrong as far as the United States is concerned. In terms of your special field of expertise, which is intelligence, what sort of role has intelligence played in this conflict?
Intelligence always plays a role, and in this case, it's played a big role in the assassination of the supreme leader, because it would be, I suspect, the CIA which informed Mossad on where he was and how to get him. Intelligence, of course, plays a big role. But at the end of it, intelligence only provides, I won't even say guidance, but information, that this is it. This is what is possible. This is what. But ultimately, the call is political, always. Now, you know, with the shortage of LPG and things that we are facing here, gas is a bigger problem than oil because it hits the common man. The stock market is bleeding because now Trump is not only the president of the United States, he's the supreme leader. The war has its limitations. And unless you put boots on the ground, and I don't think the Americans are prepared to put boots on the ground. But once you put boots on the ground, that means you must be prepared for body bags to come back, and that the Americans would not like.
But of course, if they don't put boots on the ground, then things could just continue indefinitely.
There's a stalemate till somebody intervenes. Now, two interesting things are happening, so you must be knowing. The U.S.-China summit. The other thing is that I feel out of all this, ultimately, the leader who will emerge the strongest or the tallest is President Putin. You know, he's made it known that he's available. The Iranians, of course, they believe in martyrdom, so they are ready.
Well, that's an important point that you make.
Yeah.
And therefore, I come back once again. The martyrdom concept, as far as Iranians are concerned, I mean, is it that they anticipated that this would come and they were willing to receive it?
I'm sure they were prepared for this, or they were preparing for this. Khamenei had prepared a whole list of successors, not only for after him, but for various posts who should be appointed after him. So they've been preparing for a long haul. And like I heard an Iranian say that we are fighting for our existence. I don't know what the Americans are fighting for. It's a war of their choice, not of our choice. And as you know, sir, there were negotiations going on between the U.S. and Iran.
And they were struck halfway through the negotiations.
I think the Americans have always underestimated Iran. I'm reminded of a visit by Henry Kissinger here in 2005. I was then a member of the NSAB here, and he came to talk to us. And he said that if Iran doesn't behave, it'll be blown off the face of the earth. Now, that's 21 years ago.
21 years ago.
Iran is still there.
And despite the carpet bombing and the attacks that are happening.
Whatever.
Now, when you say that Putin may have a plan and that...
I get that sense. I get the feeling.
Well, that... The plan that, say, Putin has, or a plan that he has in terms of China supporting that plan, where does that leave us? Do we have a voice? Will somebody look at
us? I don't think we have a voice in that. There has been this axis, the China-Russia-Iran axis. It's developed over the last couple of years, and it's a very powerful axis. The Chinese are very much there. It's just that they are playing a waiting game. You know, the Chinese have time on their side. They are convinced that one day they will catch up with the United States. So we are in no hurry. But the Russians and the Chinese are very much with Iran. There's no doubt.
They've clearly indicated that.
But they've said so.
And to your knowledge, is there more than just moral support? Is there something more substantive?
Oh yeah, there would be. These missiles and all. There could be some of these missiles, the deadlier ones, could be Chinese, which they have not tested. And this is a good time for them to have them tested via Iran. Let Iran use them. Let's see how they work.
Where will the dust settle, assuming that the United States will not be able to do what it intended to do? And it's unclear because the president moves from one statement to another. Something has to give, some place where things have to stop. What would then happen? What would happen with West Asia, with Middle East? What would happen with India as a aggregate security provider that we've sometimes spoken of, at least for the Indian Ocean?
I think whenever it settles, whenever there's a ceasefire or the war ends, it'll be things as they were. Except that I think now, because of all that Iran has suffered, some concession, even if it's cosmetic, will have to be made for Iran. You know, they have talked about reparations, and they've also talked about, I mean, they've been blunt enough to say that if you want a ceasefire, we don't want a ceasefire. That's what Iran is
saying. They say that,
yeah.
Yes.
And if you want a ceasefire, then get the hell out of West Asia. You have no business here. I mean, they've gone to that extent, that get all your bases out and go. What business have you got here?
So now, in this larger picture, what is left of our special relationship with Russia? I mean, we've taken a lot of knocks because of that special relationship. Europe accepted that we have a special relationship, but then they were doing it very reluctantly. United States doesn't seem to care that we have a special relationship. At the end of the day, when we knock again and we are back together with the Russians, what is it that we still continue to cherish, value, preserve, protect?
I think in the Russian mind, it depends on us. How do you want it? How do you want to go further? I think they know India is important, and this relationship with India is important. I don't think the Russians have any doubt about that.
We have talked about a special relationship with Russia, and I think it's a valued relationship. It's
very, very, very.
It goes beyond governments. It's people as well who cherish it and value it. Now, in terms of intelligence sharing and the kind of relationship that is a meaningful relationship in professional terms, is there something that you can tell us?
Well, I can tell you in my time, and I'm going back to 1999-2000, we had a very special relationship with the Russians. And I can tell you the gentleman's name, Trubnikov, who later came here as ambassador also. He almost became a personal friend. You know, when one of the first countries, in fact, deliberately, that I visited was Russia. Soon after I arrived in Moscow, about 11 o'clock in the morning, Trubnikov arrived in the guest house where we were being put up with a bottle of vodka. And he says, "This is to welcome your arrival." And he said, "Let's say cheers." So,
and they say cheers a lot of times, no? So,
yeah.
How do you still stand on your
then
feet to
we
be able
also
to
had dinner together, his wife and my wife and him. And we were only cheering each other. I said,
right.
By the end of which, both of us were totally drunk. And he rolled down the steps, actually. But it was a very good relationship. It was a very special relationship.
And it's a two-way thing. I mean, there was, without going into confidential matters, but there was a two-way exchange of information that was important for both sides.
That's right. In fact, he suggested something at that time, which then came about at the diplomatic level. He said to me, how would you react to India, Russia, China working together? So I sort of laughed. I said, "Chief, you and I are okay, but what about the Chinese?" He said, "You say yes, and I'll get the Chinese on board."
Get the Chinese on board.
On board. So I said, I think it'll be great. Soon after that, I went to China and made the same point there. And the Chinese, in their own way, reacted very differently. Oh, very interesting. We will examine it. She was a very special relation. Special to the extent that I tell you something funny. When Trubnikov came and when I went to Moscow, he took me to meet Putin, who was then prime minister. Now when Trubnikov comes to Delhi, he says to me, take me to your prime minister. So I said, you know, our prime minister doesn't meet intelligence chiefs, which is a fact. Atalji didn't like to meet him.
Right.
So I said, he doesn't meet. He said, but are you forgetting I took you to Trumliko? So then I went to Brijesh and I said, please, sir, please get him a cup of tea with the prime minister because otherwise he won't get off my back. And Atalji made that exception.
Now, I want to ask you about one interesting book that you've written, and that's Spy Chronicles. I think the book that you've written, co-authored with the former ISI chief, Asad Durrani. Now, how does this happen?
It's one of those flukes which happen. And I was telling somebody, it won't happen in the next 1,000 years. It's just happened. You see, we used to meet regularly at this these track two meetings.
Right.
And one of these track two channels was hosted by the University of Ottawa, by Peter Jones. And so Peter would see us, you know, being friendly at these meetings and things. And he once remarked that you guys are so friendly, why don't you write a book together? So I looked at the general and I laughed and I looked at the general and he said, don't be silly. Even if we wrote fiction, nobody will believe us. So forget about this. Then Peter asked us to do a piece on intelligence cooperation, which we did. And it was published simultaneously in the Dawn and in the Hindu. And then I had written this book on Kashmir, the Vajpayee years, my first book on Kashmir. Now, this book went to Pakistan, and I asked Durrani, I said, how has it been received in Pakistan? I was a bit concerned that, well, what would the Pakistanis think? Am I a liar? Am I bluffing? So he said, it's been received very well. And then he came up to me and said, you know, I think now we should do a book together. The thing is that the whole idea of that book actually was to try and tell people on both sides that peace is necessary. Peace is good for both sides. And one of the things that Durrani says in that book, you'll notice if you've read that book, and he said that Kashmir should be a bridge between India and Pakistan. But now he makes a different point, I think, which is needs to be taken into account in what is happening in West Asia. And he says that the price of peace sometimes is much more than the price of war. And that is why the Iranians cannot stop. I would put it like that.
All right. Okay, that's interesting. Now, from your experience as somebody who's led intelligence agencies, now, one thing that is I have curiosity about, and I think it's not been made apparent anywhere, is between intelligence services in the country...
There's a competition always.
Is there competition? Jealousy, is there rivalry? What is it? What's the kind of relationship that you have?
Where there's rivalry, like the our agencies and the ISI, for instance.
Uh-huh.
I was once in Karachi for one of these track two meetings, and some cameraman came and asked me, and at the end said, "What do you think of the ISI?" I said, "The ISI is great. I would love to be ISI chief." But on a more serious level, this is a question I raised with Durrani. It's in the book, Spy Chronicle. I asked him. I said, you guys are autonomous. You do what you like. He said, no, it's not like that. And he said to me, he acknowledged, he says, professionally, you guys are much superior because for you, it's a career, it's a livelihood. In our case, we have Faujis who come and go. So there is a difference. And he said, you guys are superior.
It seems that we are very careful about telling the world about the achievements of such remarkable people. We reward them, we give them awards, but we keep them under a cover. There isn't flamboyance, there isn't great proclamations, etc. Does that not affect the morale of these people that have served you with tremendous, tremendous integrity?
All the more well-known intelligence agencies have had their histories written. We are very coy about it. Now, I feel this history, at least of the Intelligence Bureau, which is more than 100 years old now, should be written somewhere.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I believe that we've touched upon some interesting issues that face us today, and we're not clear as to how they'll resolve themselves. But it's so important that someone with your vast experience can reflect on those and perhaps show us the way.
Thank you very much, sir. I hope I haven't offended anybody.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.